Hello there. Today is Wednesday, January 1st. Happy New Year from all of us at VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up on the show, a tumultuous world welcomes in a new decade. An attack on the U.S. Embassy in Iraq.
Defense Secretary Mark Esper has warned of more potential attacks should U.S. forces come under fire.
Also ahead, former President Barack Obama's 2019 music list for the year. It's all on today's International Edition. The world is welcoming in 2020. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Among the first places to see the new year, New Zealand, where they set off a half ton of fireworks in Auckland. More than a million people gathered in Sydney, Australia to watch the fireworks, which were delayed by 15 minutes due to strong winds. Here at home, New York City's counterterrorism czar expects Times Square to be the safest place on planet Earth on this New Year's Eve, to use his words. Thousands of police officers will be on duty, along with special units that have long guns and bomb-sniffing dogs, among other weapons. I'm Rita Foley.
The State Department says all American personnel are safe after hundreds of protesters came under fire, protesters, Iraqi Shiite militiamen and their supporters broke into the U.S. Embassy compound in Baghdad Tuesday. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports on what happened.
Amid anger over U.S. airstrikes on an Iran-backed militia in Iraq, dozens of militiamen and supporters broke into the giant compound in an unprecedented attack, with American guards responding with tear gas. The State Department says all Americans are secure and there are no plans to evacuate the embassy. Two defense officials say a small number of Marines specially trained to protect diplomatic missions will go to Baghdad. President Trump is blaming Iran for the attack and calling for Iraqi forces to protect the embassy. The breach and the airstrikes represent a major downturn in U.S.-Iraqi relations. Baghdad has condemned the strikes, and its security forces made no effort to stop protesters marching to the embassy. Sagar Magani at the Pentagon.
The U.S. military said the strikes were in retaliation for last week's killing of an American contractor in a rocket attack on an Iraqi military base. Iraq's interior minister says the country's prime minister had warned the U.S. that airstrikes would have serious consequences. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb says officials there think there could be more violence to come.
Defense Secretary Mark Esper has warned of more potential attacks should U.S. forces come under fire.
We will take additional actions as necessary to ensure that we act in our own self-defense and we deter further bad behavior from militia groups or from Iran.
But experts such as Michael O'Hanlon worry any tit-for-tat potentially could aid Iran in disrupting U.S. financial and security interests in the region.
Senior State Department officials say that in Iraq alone, Iranian-backed proxies have attacked bases hosting U.S. and international forces 11 times in the past 2 months. And defense analysts suspect Iran and its proxies will continue to attack oil facilities and coalition forces. Reporting at the Pentagon, I'm Carla Babb, VOA News.
Ambassador David Mack, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs and a scholar at the Middle East Institute, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi about the complicated situation evolving in Iraq.
Well, there are two things going on here. There's continuing political turmoil in Iraq with a very difficult situation for the government. The government has, in effect, collapsed, has been unable to deal with these popular disturbances in the streets. They're searching for a new prime minister, and the existing prime minister has lost his credibility. And in this case, he was obviously unable to respond to an attack on an Iraqi base. And so far as I'm aware, there was no response from the Iraqi authority. But I don't want to say that the Iraqi government is to blame. blame for this. In effect, this shows the bankruptcy of the Trump foreign policy in dealing with crises in the Middle East. The tendency has been, with the exception of a few very close partnerships like that between the U.S. and Israel, the tendency has been to rely upon U.S. military force rather than diplomacy and efforts to achieve consensus with our Arab partners in the area. I just want to point out that the U.S. had a very tepid and lukewarm response to the Iranian attack on the vital Saudi oil installations at Abqaiq. We sent out some Patriot missiles with a few Americans, and we basically told the Saudis, good luck, you better make a big fat contract with Raytheon to teach you how to use those Patriot missiles, because we're not going to keep our people there very long. That's what's in effect is happening there. That was on September 14. What kind of message did that send to Iran? It sent Iran the message that it could get away with all kinds of things in the region. Now we see that Iran has probably provoked these attacks by one of its popular mobilization units in Iraq, with which Iran has considerable influence and to which Iran provides considerable support, probably including missiles that can be used for such an attack. So far, with the popular demonstrations going on in Iraq, Iran has been on the defensive because these demonstrators, most of whom are Shia Muslims, have been attacking Iranian installations, Iranian consulates in places like Basra and Karbala. And the crowds have been chanting for Iran to get out of Iraqi politics. Now, this has enabled Iran and its close allies within Iraq to turn the tables on the Iraqi government and on the U.S. and to try to make this an issue against the U.S. presence in Iraq rather than the Iranian influence within Iraqi politics.
Iraq's Interior Minister Yassin Al-Yasri said that the Prime Minister of Iraq had warned the U.S. strikes on the Shiite militiamen would have serious consequences, and he said this is one of the implications.
Well, I have no doubt that that's true. It doesn't deal with the question of why the Iraqi security forces themselves did not take measures to deal with the perpetrators of this attack, which I emphasize again, was on an Iraqi base. If American military contractors who are involved in training Iraqis on using American military equipment are not safe from such an attack, and if the Iraqi government cannot provide them some safety, it's not too surprising that the Iraqis might expect that there would be an American attack. I am not justifying the American attack so much as I am saying that the Iraqi government failed to meet its obligation to provide protection for people working on its own base, and it's failed to deal with the perpetrators. And at the same time, the U.S. is responsible for having neglected its political relationship with a government in Iraq that was trying to do its best. And it's that kind of attitude which has caused this almost total breach of political consensus and diplomatic interchange between the government in Washington and the government in Baghdad.
Mr. Ambassador, does the Iraqi government's angry reaction to the U.S. airstrikes and its apparent decision not to prevent the protesters from reaching the embassy signal a sharp deterioration of U.S.-Iraq relations?
I thought the U.S.-Iraqi relations were in pretty bad shape already. They've had a couple of months here of relative calm in U.S.-Iraqi relations because so much of the focus of the angry demonstrators was against Iran. But I didn't see much was being done to improve U.S.-Iraqi relations in the meantime. So now when we really need a close relationship with the government of Adel Abdel Mahdi, but we did very little, so far as I can see, to bolster that relationship during this period when we could have done so.
That's Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs and a scholar at the Middle East Institute, speaking with my colleague, VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is warning of a shocking action and then backs away from his testing moratorium. Many Sudanese are seeing death sentences for protester killings as a hope for justice. prominent Russian opposition figure is completely pessimistic about Western curbs on Moscow corruption. And fireworks, parties, and fake snow. Welcome in 2020. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. When lawmakers head back to Washington just after the new year, they will again be focused on details of how to conduct an impeachment trial. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine says she's open to calling witnesses as part of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump, and said it's inappropriate for Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to pledge total coordination between the White House and Senate during the trial.
It is inappropriate, in my judgment, for senators on either side of the aisle to prejudge the evidence.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski said last week that she was disturbed by McConnell's comments, adding that there should be distance between the White House and Senate in how the trial is conducted. The remarks by the GOP senators come as a new media report provided details about efforts by acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney and other officials to cut off the aid to Ukraine. The report said several top Trump administration officials tried to warn him against withholding aid to Ukraine. Joining us to talk about it is Claire Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy and faculty director at the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Thank you for being with us. Do you think that this latest evidence that Trump's top advisors warned him not to do this could be a problem?
These new revelations are a big deal because they suggest that there are at least three potential witnesses out there, among them the current Secretary of State and the former National Security Advisor, that would be very powerful witnesses if they were to testify.
What would it say?
They come from within the Trump orbit, and they would say, hey, we were opposed to this from the start. We regarded this as a big deal at the time, and we did not think that it was a good idea to withhold aid from Ukraine. We didn't think it was the right thing to do.
Would that weaken the president's argument, or for that matter, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's arguments that there's no need to even really have this big trial with witnesses and documents? Because so far, all of these people have been prevented by President Trump from testifying. And of course, we know that Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi are sort of in a standoff now about how a Senate impeachment trial would look, with Pelosi refusing to hand over the impeachment documents until Mitch McConnell promises some sort of fair trial with witnesses, which he said he's not going to have.
It really strengthens both articles of impeachment. It strengthens the first article of impeachment because it really shows that the president abused his office. It shows that he intended not to turn over aid to Ukraine. It showed that he received advice from those in his close circle not to take this path and that he persisted. But even more strongly, it supports the second article of impeachment, the obstruction of Congress, because his insistence that individuals close to him not testify, like Bolton and like Mick Mulvaney and like Pompeo, that his insistence that those individuals not testify demonstrates that he knew exactly what they were going to say. They were going to speak out against him in very clear and convincing terms. And he was therefore motivated, strongly motivated, to have them not testify, not because of some specious claim about executive privilege, but because he knew that their testimony would be incriminated. That's the essence of an obstruction charge.
So does that mean he can't use that reasoning for not allowing them to testify, that he cannot say this is executive privilege?
He should not be able to say they are not allowed to testify because of executive privilege. First of all, a federal district court already said that even the president's lawyer, Don McGahn, was not protected by executive privilege. Still less would be individuals like Pompeo, who didn't have an attorney-client relationship with the president. Executive privilege cannot shield a president who is under an impeachment inquiry from having witnesses come and testify before Congress again.
So what if Mitch McConnell refuses witnesses? Then even if this media report is 100% accurate, if there are no witnesses testifying, it really won't make any difference, will it?
Well, this is why, in my view, Nancy Pelosi should not have brought this to a vote on impeachment in the House before the House had been able to hear from these witnesses. I have thought from the start that hearing from Mick Mulvaney, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and so on, Mark Esper, that hearing from these individuals has been essential to the Democrats' case. Now that the House has impeached without hearing from these witnesses, they're doing the only thing they can do, which is to hold up referring to the Senate until they have assurance that these witnesses are going to be part of the process. Without these witnesses, I think as a political matter, the Democrats have no case. Not as a factual matter or as a legal matter, but as a political matter, because Republicans will not be convinced, particularly Republicans in the Senate, that there are impeachable offenses here until they hear from members of the administration or former members of the administration. But once that happens, I think that there could be an abrupt turnaround on the case.
But if the president is blocking these people from testifying and it could take months for each one to have a decision made, then wouldn't she have just been holding up what she says was a national security issue and also getting closer to an election, which would be somewhat unethical?
I'm not sure that it's unethical. This is the first president to be impeached in his first term in office. Given that she knows that there are essential witnesses that the Senate does not plan to call, she is in the right not to refer the matter to the Senate until she can be sure that the witnesses will be called and that there will be a fair trial. It is a matter of the gravest national security importance for all the relevant witnesses to be heard in the Senate when this trial takes place. I don't think it would be a disaster if the impeachment proceedings rolled past the next election. Either it will become much less irrelevant, of course, because Trump may not win re-election, or if he does win re-election, it continues to be relevant and important. And so I think it's critical that it be done the right way, that the right witnesses be called. And if it rolls over past the next election, that's not the worst thing that would happen. The worst thing that would happen is that he would be acquitted without hearing from the witnesses in the Senate, that the American people are never fully exposed to the truth, and that he's reelected on the basis of, in part, of that acquittal and continues to pose a grave danger to the security of the country. And yet the American people are not exposed to the truth about what he's done in all of its full detail. And now he would be impeached and would be unstoppable because he'll no longer be afraid of impeachment. He'll no longer be afraid of having witnesses testify against him. He'll feel that he's won that battle as well. And he'll just be unstoppable in the second term.
Claire Finkelstein, she is a professor of law and philosophy and the faculty director at the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Thank you for being with us. Thousands of people took shelter on a beach to escape bushfires in the Australian state of Victoria. The seaside town of Mallacoota was surrounded by flames. There have been multiple emergency warnings in Victoria and South Wales. At least two people have died and dozens of homes feared lost. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The sky in Mallacoota was turned a grotesque red as strong winds pushed out of control bushfires towards the popular seaside town about 500 kilometres east of Melbourne. Thousands of people were trapped and sought shelter on the beach. Some waded into the water to escape red-hot embers that rained down. Others fled by boat and watched as the flames approached.
That behind me is Mallacoota. Now the fire front's come through. Everyone's safe and sound. Got the girls and the dogs up the front. Got supplies, but I hope everyone's just get into the water. It's chaos. I've never seen anything like it.
There was relief in Mallacoota later Monday when a change in wind direction diverted the fires away from the town. But once again, very hot temperatures and gusty winds have conspired to make this another dangerous and destructive day. At least two people have died, and several others are unaccounted for as dozens of blazes burn in southeastern Australia. The authorities fear many houses have been lost. The New South Wales Rural Fire Service Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons said this was the state's worst bushfire season on record. As the fires rage, so has the debate over Sydney's lavish New Year's Eve fireworks display. Thousands of people signed a petition calling the event an insult to bushfire-hit regions, but organisers said it was too late to cancel the festivities. 12 people have died since the crisis began in September. What Australia needs is fire-drenching rain, but no significant falls are expected for at least another month. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, Americans said goodbye to a number of prominent citizens in 2019. The AP's Ed Donahue has this report.
People like Congressman Elijah Cummings, who championed for the poor and for immigrants.
What country is that? This is the United States of America.
Retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens was the leader of its liberal wing and a proponent of abortion rights and consumer protections.
At the very least, I know that learning on the bench has been one of the most important and rewarding aspects of my own experience.
Ross Perot ran for president in 1992. He recorded the highest percentage for an independent or third-party candidate since 1912.
You don't care about anything but making money. There will be a giant sucking sound going south.
Lee Iacocca became a folk hero, rescuing one of Detroit's big three.
You know, when I first took this crazy job, they were ready to bury Chrysler. Last year, you made us the fastest growing car and truck company in America.
And the leader of the Islamic State group was killed.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
I'm Ed Donahue.
2019 also saw a disease that's totally preventable claim the lives of more than 140,000 people, mostly children and babies, all because they missed getting two doses of the measles vaccine. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that unvaccinated children created a pathway for measles outbreaks globally.
Samoan parents never expected to face such grief.
I was shocked. It was very hard for me to accept what happened.
It's very hard to lose a child. Sorry. She's gone and I never forget her the way I try to teach her how to talk.
Measles claimed the lives of more than 80 Samoans, mostly children and infants.
Two shots of a vaccine could have saved those children's lives.
The vaccination rate in Samoa dropped to about 30% after two children died from a measles vaccine that was mixed with a muscle relaxant instead of water. Parents panicked, and anti-vaccination activists convinced them to avoid the vaccine. Then measles exploded on the island.
The hospitals and health clinics were overrun with very sick children, and there weren't enough healthcare workers and hospital beds to adequately deliver the services that they needed.
The Samoan government started a massive vaccination effort. It then turned to the CDC for help.
CDC also was asked to do training of healthcare workers to ensure safe vaccine delivery, as well as to monitor the quality of the immunization campaign that took place.
In 2019, more than 400,000 cases of measles were reported globally, with an additional 250,000 cases in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the first 3 months of 2019, the number of measles cases tripled over the same period last year.
The main reason for failure to vaccinate against measles is families, communities are not having access to the vaccine.
Two doses of the measles vaccine will protect children from the disease. Yet conflict and poor health systems in low-income countries prevent families from vaccinating their children. In rich countries, vaccinations are declining too. Some parents are opting out of immunizations. The United States tops the list, with 2.5 million children missing their first dose of the measles vaccine. In 2019, the CDC reported that more than 1,000 cases of measles in 31 states by late December, the highest number in 25 years.
And then in the United States now, we've got measles outbreaks and epidemics are becoming a new normal in this country after we've eliminated measles in 2000.
The WHO took away the measles eradication status of four European countries because of outbreaks and their low immunization rates.
In other words, we're backsliding.
Samoa concluded its state of emergency just before 2019 ended, but the resurgence of measles remains a global health problem. Unless children get vaccinated, there will be more deaths and more measles outbreaks in 2020. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Former President Barack Obama has unveiled his favorite songs of 2019, and the list is quite diverse. The nation's 44th president writes, from hip-hop to country to the boss, here are my songs of the year. If you're looking for something to keep you company on a long drive or help you turn up a workout, I hope there's a track or two in here that does the trick. Some on the list include Go by the Black Keys, Show Me Love by Alicia Keys, Old Town Road Remix by Lil Nas X featuring Billy Cyrus, Hello Sunshine by Bruce Springsteen, and of course, breakout star Lizzo's song Juice. When Lizzo heard she was on the former president's list, she tweeted, "I love you so much, Mr. Obama. Thanks for assisting me with my morning cry." Well, that does it for our last show of 2019 and our first of 2020. We thank you so much for being with us and listening to our program. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a very happy and healthy new year. Try. I like shot and make it better all the time.